people hold on to that belief really, really deeply, that there's something about language learning that can be neutral, and that I don't think is possible. If I say this is going to be a target language only space, that is its own kind of language policy. But I think more often teachers are behaving or engaging as policy actors without having thought about why that might be. Relational changes you make with people around you, your students, those sort of relational changes are the ones that matter the most to me.
You're listening to Speaking of Language, a podcast recorded at the Language Resource Center at Cornell University. Each week, we explore a topic related to language pedagogy and second language acquisition. This week, on Speaking of Language,
Dr. Jeff Bale of the University of Toronto's Ontario Institute for Studies in Education discusses the ties between language policy, culture, and race, and how educators and communities can affect change.
Welcome to a new episode of Speaking of Language. I'm Angelica Kramer, the director of the Language Resource Center at Cornell University.
And I'm Sam Lupowitz, the LRC's media manager. Today, we will discuss language policy, anti-racism, and change with Dr. Jeff Bale, who recently gave a talk as part of our monthly LRC speaker series on this topic. You can watch his talk on our website.
Welcome to Speaking of Language, Jeff.
Thank you, Angelica. Thank you, Sam.
So excited to have you here.
So we always like to start out our podcast by having our guests talk about their background and path with languages. So what does that look like for you?
How much time you got? So I began with, a non-English language when I was maybe 8 or 9 years old. I forget now. I sang in a children's choir in Chicago, in suburban Chicago, where I lived for a time. This was run by the Park District. The total serendipity of having this world-class choral director teaching or directing this children's choir.
Wow.
Which basically was, I think, cheap daycare for my parents. They both worked. I'm a classic Gen X kid. Both parents worked. And we sang with the Chicago Symphony. We were the children's voices for the CSO. And we sang a lot in German.
Oh.
So I learned how to pronounce German at a very young age and sing. I didn't know what I was saying. and then when I was 10, we went on tour with the CSO to then West Germany for 3 or 4 weeks. In fact, we stayed in Bad Neuenahr, where the floods were a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And so sang in an old folks' home in Bad Hersfeld on the former, like the trizonal point, like east-west in what was then Czechoslovakia. As a 10-year-old singing Let There Be Peace on Earth to a bunch of older folks in an old folks' home, and of course they're crying their eyes out. I don't really understand why. I was just a kid. But that experience, I could have gone to Bogota, I could have gone to Moscow, I could have gone to Timbuktu, but that experience of being that young really got me sort of hooked on German. And then when it was time to pick a language in grade school, in grade 7, I picked German, and I went all the way, undergraduate master's degree, and then I used German professionally for my research on education policy.
Sehr schön.
Ja, danke.
So tell us a little bit more about what you do right now in your professional life.
I am an associate professor in the Language and Literacy Education Program in the Department of Curriculum, Teaching, and Learning. Ooh, that's a mouthful. At the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education, or OISE, one of the more unfortunate acronyms of the world, which is a faculty of education at the University of Toronto in Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Wow. Say that 3 times
fast.
I need
a break.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Fantastic.
Sorry. So yes, I'm an associate professor. I currently serve as the vice president for university and external affairs for our faculty association, which is the closest thing to a union as we have. I'm also the program director for LLE right now. So
goodness.
I have a bit of things on my plate right now.
Yeah.
But our program, maybe people will know the name Meryl Swain, Jim Cummins, Sharon Lapkin, Alistair Cumming, Nina Spada. Can't forget Nina. Sorry, Nina. some of the names that made the program in very, very famous. Mm-hmm. That all the names of the program have changed over the years. And its current instantiation is LLE. And that's where I work. And
fantastic.
So I do work on language policy and teacher education as well.
Yeah. So speaking about your work and the talk that you gave here, you have investigated the Heritage Languages Program, or HLP, in Ontario. Mm. Tell us more about your work and the educational policies around heritage language education.
So there's lots to say, so you're going to have to stop me if I ramble on for too long. But the starting point is that education in Canada is highly federalized, similar to the U.S., mm-hmm. although maybe the next degree, there is no federal, in our case, Ministry of Education, mm-hmm. the way there is in the U.S. Across many provinces in the 1970s, a whole series of policies emerged to support heritage language instruction in the, at the school level.
Yeah.
I do think they are a consequence, or they're, maybe it's the wrong word, they're implicated, they're caught up in the emergence of official bilingualism and the mm-hmm. official multiculturalism mm-hmm. policy at the federal level, which maybe I can say more about later. But it's, in other words, it isn't an accident that in the 70s
sure.
These policies emerged. So the one in Ontario, it actually was not the first. It was towards the end of this wave. And it was, in many ways, a compromise, as most Canadian political maneuvers are a compromise. Mm-hmm. In many ways, a policy that pleased no one. It sort of institutionalized heritage language instruction. It gave the opportunity for parents to make requests to school boards or school districts. They're called boards there, for heritage language programs. But school boards at that time could say no. They could deny those requests, and many did. So in that sense, it was sort of caught in the middle. It was a nod towards heritage languages and the migrant communities that wanted to include them in schools, mm-hmm. but also many of the stipulations of this policy, I argue, situated the policy at the margins of school of school life. So it became a really, really important site of conflict for about a decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the study I talked about at the presentation earlier today is about the terrain of that conflict and the mm-hmm. the dynamics of that for the first 10 years.
Interesting.
You also discussed notions of thick solidarity regarding activism of various groups around HLP. Can you expand on that a bit?
Sure. So one of the maybe assumptions or one of the questions I had when I started this work, I really can't say I am a we. It's always been a collective project with Eve mm-hmm. Hawk, a dear friend and a colleague at York University, and a wonderful team of graduate students who've sort of cycled through over the years. So it's always been a we. But I will say this probably is more my assumption, is that no single community can win these sort of educational programs on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So it assumes or presupposes some sort of collaboration, some sort of work in solidarity to make them happen. And yet, we know from the data we're looking at, these are mostly archival data, but now we're moving into oral history data, that there are also lots of tensions across communities, particularly tensions between the Black population in Toronto, which at that time was largely a Caribbean descendant population, who, in other words, they were also migrants, similar to Italians, to South Asian folks, to folks from Chile. There was a big wave of Chileans who came to Toronto, to Canada in the 70s after Allende was overthrown. So lots of people from all over the world, but there wasn't necessarily an automatic synergy or connection or sense that we all have similar interests. So on the one hand, if we know that it takes collaboration and solidarity to win these sort of major educational improvements, we know that. But on the other hand, there's lots of tension that we're seeing in the data. So thick solidarity is a, I guess, a phrase or a term that Liu and Shange wrote about in 2018. Mm-hmm. And they're writing across their own difference. So Liu is an Asian American or Chinese American scholar. Shange is an African American scholar. And this article they wrote, it's a really a beautifully written article. Besides the content, the way it's written is really beautiful. They start by reflecting on their own upbringing and the sorts of, particularly in Liu's case, the anti-Black racism in her family and her community that was sort of all around her, and how she worked to think differently about that, to challenge that. And in Shange's case as well, the sort of maybe more anti-immigrant sentiment that's, that can sometimes be present in the Black community, and how they've learned to work across that difference. And for them, they theorize that as a kind of thick solidarity that can recognize the differences in experiences, that can recognize that or assumes that we don't have to have the same kinds of experiences in order to find some sort of shared unity or shared shared goal. And in fact, this approach to solidarity they theorize presupposes that we have to allow for that difference to continue. And how do you hold space for that difference while also working towards a common goal? So I find it very useful to help think about the tensions between and across communities in the 70s and 80s, debating what kind of heritage language programs, what kind of Black cultural heritage programs should exist,
sure.
on whose terms, to what towards what goals. There, as you heard in the talk, there wasn't a lot of this sort of thick mm-hmm. solidarity. There are moments of maybe responding to racist backlash against the HLP mm-hmm. and against Black cultural heritage programs, where it was easier to link arms and work together. But those are thin. They're momentary.
Sure.
They're fleeting.
Nope.
And the sort of thicker version that allows for differences, that can hear debate, that can as they write, as Liu and Shange write, can withstand tension, with can literally hear someone challenging you and still find space to work together. That was absent in that time, but I think it's something that's really useful mm-hmm. and necessary to bring things forward now.
Mm-hmm. So what are the ramifications for today then? What does this all look like today?
Well, it's actually the starting point for our study. So the we're using a particular approach to doing historical work called genealogy, which Michel Foucault theorized or argued was doing histories of the present, which is to say we take the landscape, if you will, the lay of the land for language education programs in Ontario as they currently are.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, these things are taken for granted, which mm-hmm. means in Ontario, everybody in the English language school system has to learn French for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's grades 4 to 8 plus mm-hmm. 1 year in high school. That's actually required by provincial law. And there is space for heritage languages. There is space for Indigenous languages, but they are, I argue, fully on the margins of school life. But that's typically the scene as that's the way it is. That's the maybe normal way or the obvious way things should be. And it's not questioned how we got here. It's not questioned mm-hmm. why is it this way? How does policy both create and recreate that setup? How do our own expectations for language learning both reflect and then reinforce this mm-hmm. the setup of language education? So our intention by looking to the past is to understand better the really, really intense debates and conflicts that happened over this particular program to see what was possible, or the kinds mm-hmm. of demands that parent groups are making,
yeah.
or the kinds of demands that kids are making, particularly middle school and high school age kids, making very clear arguments of what kind of programs they wanted to see. And what can we learn from that today to be able to maybe change how we think and act relative to heritage language learning in Ontario in the here and now?
Terrific. While the situation of bilingualism and heritage education is unique in Canada, what can other countries learn? How does this transcend borders?
It's a great question. I joked with my hosts at dinner last night that I feel as part of my professional and political obligation to debunk some of the assumptions that Canada mm-hmm. is some progressive dreamland and mm-hmm. all those sort of things.
Hang on, don't debunk that.
I'm about to do that right now, actually.
I don't know if you heard. It's an election year in the States.
So my academic training is in the applied linguistic field of language policy, and yeah. Canada is a poster case, right?
Mm.
Official bilingualism, how it came to be, and so on and so forth. Official bilingualism absolutely resolves one kind of tension in Canada between Anglophones and Francophones,
mm, sure.
between two different white settler communities. But those policies and the whole culture around official bilingualism then creates a whole new set of problems, a whole mm-hmm. new set of constraints for other communities in Canada, particularly for Indigenous peoples mm-hmm. and for other migrant groups to Canada. So one thing that's, I think, important to recognize is that educational policies can solve one set of problems, but like most things in life, when they do that, they create 10 more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So official bilingualism certainly resolved a particular kind of problem between two different white settler groups, the French and the English, and the immense set of policy frameworks, funding, the culture around that is often seen as a sign of progress or a sign of being progressive and inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
I can say more about the limitations of official bilingualism, even for French and English later on if you'd like, but that particular policy framework has actually created, I would say, further constraints for other groups who want to enjoy their own languages and cultures at school, particularly for Indigenous groups and for other migrant groups. So one important lesson is to think differently about a maybe one-size-fits-all approach to educational
sure.
policy,
yeah.
or even a sense of doing things, not piecemeal, but doing things sequentially
mm-hmm.
that will solve one sort of big social problem first and deal with other ones later.
Yeah.
That's quite literally how the Royal Commission that established official binding worldism, they literally said to Indigenous groups, look, your questions are really complicated. We're going to defer that to a later date. And they effectively blew them off. And that later date came, I guess, in 2019. So the Indigenous Languages Act was finally received royal assent, which is the final step in policymaking or in lawmaking in Canada. So that was a space of 50 years between the emergence of official bilingualism in 1969 and the ILA in 2019. So one lesson to think about beyond Canadian borders is policymaking processes and how they can actually erect new constraints for other groups of people who want to enjoy the benefits or make change for them for themselves. A second way to address that question is to think differently about which languages are assumed or believed to belong in school or not. So I think it is taken for granted that that Canada is a place where English and French are the well, they are the official languages, of course, but it's taken for granted that that therefore means those are the only schools we need to worry about in school or to make space for in school. And yet Canada, the space that is now Canada, has always been multilingual. There's a really important research about Indigenous multilingualisms that are always present before colonization, before European contact. But certainly now Canada is one of the most linguistically diverse countries on earth. And so understanding the terms of debates, the terms of conflict in, you know, a particular province in Canada may not be interesting. The details may not be interesting to an international audience, but the ways we make sense of that, the ways we theorize from that, the ways we make change based on that can be useful for other parts of the world who are recognizing the kinds of linguistic diversity in their own school systems, in their own societies, and saying, how should we do things differently?
Yeah, that's great. So you just referenced some of the limitations of official bilingualism. Can you expand on that for us? What are those limitations?
Well, I think things that would be uncontroversial to say is that official bilingualism does not refer to individual people. That is to say, the goal has never been to, well, never is a big word. The from a policy perspective, the goal has not been to produce all Canadian people as being bilingual.
Sure.
Rather, it's been a guarantee that whatever linguistic community you belong to, Anglophone or Francophone, you have the right to access the state services, to be served in your language of choice. And that has consequences for how those languages are therefore taught.
Sure.
You then need a bilingual workforce, right?
Yeah.
But that is not the same as saying that the goal or the ideal, I'm not going to say ideal. I think there is a national ideal that people are bilingual. But the actual policy, the point is not necessarily to produce individual bilingualism.
Yeah.
It's more at the state level.
Mm.
So that's an uncontroversial way to think about the limitations. The more perhaps controversial way to think about the limitations are what I started to suggest earlier. One is how the policy came to be. So Eve Hawk has written, I think, the book on this topic that I don't think is actually read widely enough generally, but certainly not in Canada. In 2012, this is the book version of her dissertation, and she uses actually a very similar historical method that we're using for this project called genealogy to make sense of how official bilingualism came to be understood as the major social problem of the time, the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a number of things that Canada was facing in the 1960s, but official bilingualism was the one that then got put on the table as the one the federal government has to intervene in, to make a plan around. It did so via the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, which ran from 63 to 69. And what Eve does so brilliantly in her book is to go through both the official, the books. There are four books written as part of the commission's work, but also the records of the briefs that were written, the deputations that were given to analyze how demands made by Indigenous organizations and people and by what were then called other ethnic communities were summarily dismissed. Like I said earlier, particularly for Indigenous peoples, as they described their own language practices, their own demands around language and culture, the commission responded in one way saying, this is a little too complicated for us, so we're going to defer for another day.
Sure.
We're talking about the English and the French here. But they also used openly colonial and racist ideas to say your languages can't really belong to a modern Canada. These are not, they didn't use the word primordial. Eve uses that word to analyze it, but these are languages that don't fit a modern society.
Interesting.
And don't really belong in that way. Mm. And for other ethnic communities, they were also really ignored, really, really blown off and ignored. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The most active were Ukrainian Canadians, but not only. Their demands for a place at the table were not met, not even listened to, let alone met. So you have this whole infrastructure around official bilingualism that has worked to, this is Eve's argument, not mine, to work to reinforce racialized hierarchies of language that already existed in Canada. But just to solidify them as part of the modern Canadian state in many ways. It's a major, major constraint. So now when you have populations arriving saying, wait a minute, why can't I learn my language or why can't I receive services in my language? The answer is, well, official bilingualism. So it functions as a real block to being able to even imagine other kinds of services, let alone begin to provide them.
Fascinating.
Language programs across the United States have seen increases in heritage speakers. What advice do you have for our colleagues to ensure we provide the best possible language education for these students?
That's a big question. I don't teach heritage languages. I can't claim expertise on what the inside of a heritage language classroom looks like. It's always been, yes, the central contradiction in my professional career. I'm in applied linguistics, but my kind of application is about policy and politics, not necessarily around teaching, even though I'm also a very experienced language teacher. I will say, I think the experience of heritage programs of being under-resourced, meaning a lack of curricular materials, in many cases, a lack of a trained teaching force in the sense of certainly in our context, there are plenty of people who were trained as teachers in their home country.
Sure.
But that's different from being trained to teach the language, right? I think those are very common phenomena around the world. In fact, I did a literature review for the annual review of applied linguistics, or for applied linguistics. It's the Journal of AAAL. I always get the four of wrong. I'll be excommunicated for that. But in any event, in 2010, I was asked to do a literature review on policies for heritage language education. And I, for a number of reasons, focused on Anglophone countries around the world and broke it up by region. And what I was, this is 15 years ago, so maybe things have changed. But one of many findings from that paper were that irrespective of coming from a wealthier country or perhaps a less resourced country or marginalized country economically, irrespective of the status of the so-called heritage language in the country, the conditions of heritage language education were really similar. Again, a lack of curriculum materials, a lack of teacher education or a way of thinking about teacher education, a lack of trained educators themselves, a sense of this being at best a resource to get towards some other kind of language practice rather than learning a heritage language as an end unto itself. Like these conditions that I read in, the 120 or 30 papers I reviewed for this article in ARAL, all argued or reported similar things. And I wasn't expecting to find that. I would have thought maybe you see differences in, say, wealthier countries versus less wealthy countries, or countries like Canada that have very active heritage language policies versus others like the U.S., where now there are more, but back then there weren't as many. So that commonality really took me aback. I think the research, this is the research my students are doing now, my doctoral students, and when I say my personally, but also across Canada, the big, big, big questions people are asking are how to attend to plurilingualism or translanguaging, whatever way you theorize that, how to think about the use of multiple languages in the heritage language context. I think especially because of the fraught conditions of heritage languages in various societies, there's a really, really firm belief among heritage teachers that this is the only space we have for the language, so you cannot use X language. And yet we know that's not necessarily the way people learn languages the best. So I have a really, really lovely studies about what does it mean not only to use the dominant language, whatever that might be in your context, alongside of the heritage language, but multiple languages, minoritized languages at the same time. That's a very exciting and productive research line, I think, to help think differently about language teaching. The other one that is, I think, growing really fast right now, at least in Canada, because of the size of the Chinese diasporic population,
sure.
is attention to different Chinese languages. Mm-hmm. So there, in the past, Cantonese may have been the main Chinese language taught in Canada. Now it's by far Mandarin. Yet the... I'm not sure we actually know a number, so I don't want to give a majority or minority, but I'll just say a significant number of students who are in heritage language programs for Chinese, bring multiple Chinese languages to that space. Yeah. And yet there's almost no attention paid to that in instruction. And again, even if Mandarin is the target language, how do Mandarin teachers who claim expertise in this, but how do they attend to the different Chinese languages in the room? Mm-hmm. Right now, the answer is mostly they don't, which seems like a lost opportunity.
Yeah. Interesting. What got you interested in this topic and language policy in general? How did you end up with this line of research?
It's interesting. I, as an education faculty, I'm surrounded by, I identify as a queer person, and I was surrounded by people who are what I call professional gays, meaning their research is on queer studies, trans studies in some way. I am not, and I've joked about that for a long time, but actually it is through lived experience as being a teacher. So I was a classroom teacher for 10 years in the U.S. I worked in Washington, D.C. first, and then for a second in Chicago on the West Side, and my last job was in Tempe, Arizona, where Arizona State is, where I got my Ph.D., and the experience of being a white, not monolingual, but raised monolingually, a white teacher in these spaces that were just the subject of intensely racialized education policy was radicalizing for me. It was both eye-opening, but also radicalizing for me. And being in Arizona at the end was the depends how you see it, deal breaker. I left the classroom, or deal maker in terms of shaping my ideas. Mm-hmm. So I was in teaching in a high school in Tempe, Arizona from 2004 until I left just before winter break or around the holidays of 2007. Mm-hmm. And this is just in the few years just after Arizona passed a ban on bilingual education.
Oh, wow.
I guess 2001. I've actually forgotten so long ago.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't there to teach in a bilingual program. I couldn't have. It would have been illegal. Mm-hmm. But at high school, there aren't that many to begin with. So I was teaching in a high school ESL program, working with newcomers, as I almost always did. And first couple of days of school, in the hallway with the kids, teaching them how to use the locker. Mm-hmm. Most of the kids there were from northern Mexico. And that is not a phenomenon for public schools in Mexico to have a private space, because schools often share... Multiple schools share the same building, right? And so even if they knew how to use a combination lock in their life, like how to do it at school is different.
Yeah.
And I thought, look, I'm here to get this done so I can get back to class. So this is all done in Spanish in the hallway. And a teacher saw this, interrupted me to say, you're not allowed to use Spanish with the students, which actually was not true. I didn't know it at that time.
Yeah.
But I was, besides being embarrassed, I then was just really... Can I say it was pissed?
Yeah.
Because one thing experienced teachers know is you do not interrupt your peer while they're doing their work.
No kidding.
Maybe you have a chat later.
Yeah.
But you don't interrupt your peer in front of the kids.
Yeah.
And so that was just the first of many experiences like that, where Spanish was so vilified. It was seen as being such a problem. That was a very intense experience for me. So when I decided to go back to grad school, I actually wrote in my application, I don't want to be an academic. I want to work for one of the two big teachers unions and be a policy analyst. Mm. So I applied to a language policy program at Arizona State. And it just so happened that Terry Wiley, my supervisor, and Tammy McCarty, who was on my committee, and Gustavo Fishman, and others, Jeff McSwan, Chris Faltis, B. Arias, all these amazing, just incredible people, Jeannie Powers. Yeah, they were all there at Arizona State. Dave Berliner was there. So to see these politically engaged and committed professors who knew their stuff and were very committed to real, both scholarly, robust scholarly work, but also real practical change, that was a very powerful model for me. So that's how I got into the academic side of it. And then while I was there, I was taking a case study methods course with Professor Carolyn Turner. It was January of 2006, and the previous fall, then President Bush was at a meeting of maybe the Ivies. Very fitting.
Yeah.
definitely, it was at Princeton. It was at Princeton.
Yeah, okay.
And he was there to announce the National Security Language Initiative, which I mean, this crowd will know about, but it was an effort to, well, it did. It reorganized a bunch of existing language policies, but then offered some new ones.
Yep.
And I was absolutely blown away. Like, why would you learn a language to spy on somebody or to prosecute a war? The irony is I went to a PhD program that I quit from at Georgetown, which is like this with the State Department and Foreign Service. And even then, I didn't know anybody who was doing even Arabic, which is a huge, a really famous Arabic department. I didn't know anybody learning Arabic to work for the company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that I was just, in my own naive way, very, very taken aback by that. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to study that. Like, I want to know more about what is this ideological rationale or connection between national security and language learning, and what are the consequences of that for language education in the U.S. So that was my study.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, and I'm afraid you won't run out of fodder for your work.
No?
Yeah.
Well, listen, I mean, I would call myself a hypocrite. My last two grants at Michigan State were StarTalk grants. And this isn't just the proper, this is the Office of the Director of National Intelligence on StarTalk.
Mm-hmm.
But I took money with Wen Xiaowang. She graduated from our department in teacher education, and we ran these summer programs. This is back in the day when there were these, there was a Confucius Institute at MSU.
Yep.
And we ran this crash course. These mostly kids. They were mid-20s, if they were a day, recently arrived from China to become teachers in Michigan, mostly on grade schools.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was, the money was needed to support the work.
Sure.
But I was feeding at that same trough. So I recognized that. I'll call it a contradiction. Others might call it being hypocritical. But of course, there was zero connection between ideologically between. Although the opening conference every year was somebody from the Department of Defense, some big defense person was the first person to speak, which was a little bit, you know, odd. but that rationale is something I've been very perplexed by for a long time.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I guess let's jump off of that for our next question. The title of your talk ended in the word change. So what can our colleagues in language education do to affect change when it comes to policies and language practices?
Another big question. I think the most important thing, and this is maybe a hill I've been dying on for 25 years or whatever, this next January 25, I've been teaching for 30 years, which is also harsh for me to wrap my head around. Take a minute there, sorry. but I think, again, as somebody, I'm in the world of applied linguistics, I haven't felt very at home there. And so I think the most important thing about thinking about or affecting change is to get beyond the idea that the language classroom is somehow free from politics, from ideology, from division, that we can somehow, you know, shut that out as nicely insulated as this room we're talking in is, that can't be our language space, our language learning space. And I don't know what it is about language education that people hold on to that belief really, really deeply, that there's something about language learning that can be neutral or that can be free of conflict, and that I don't think is possible. So I think one way of thinking about change is to bring that work into the classroom, to make that the stuff of your classroom is really, really important. Another one I think has to do with teacher education, both preparing language teachers of adults but also of kids, is to help language teachers think of themselves as policy actors themselves. So one way to think about language policy is to see it as, well, this is a DC thing. Or an Albany thing, or whatever it is. Or maybe there's some sort of, is there an academic senate here? They set policy for Cornell, whatever it might be. And those things matter. I'm not trying to say they don't matter. But the choices I make as a teacher are also policy choices of a kind. Sure. So to go back to an earlier question, Sam, if I say this is going to be a target language-only space, that is its own kind of language policy. There may be really good reasons. You may be able to rationalize that and defend that in a way. Even if I don't agree with you, you've made a clear choice. That's great. Yeah. But I think more often teachers are acting as policy, are behaving or engaging as policy actors without having thought about why that might be.
Yeah.
So helping future teachers see themselves as policy agents in their own way can be really helpful to, even if it's changed at the more micro classroom level or at a more meso program level, those are also really important changes. I've never really been one to think about encouraging language teachers to be like to write their congresspeople or write the, like that is a kind of activism itself that's important, but my kind of change I'm talking about, particularly in the talk from earlier, it's not really about that per se. It's more about the relational changes you make with people around you, your students, the families they come from, the communities they're embedded in. Those sort of relational changes are the ones that matter the most to me.
Jeff, this is tremendously important work that you are doing. Thank you for doing all of this. We might have to get you back stateside so that you can do all that work looking at language policy.
To live here, you mean? No, thank you.
Okay, well, maybe you can stay in Canada, but research all the language policies here and make recommendations on how we can make this world a better place. But where can our listeners find out more about you and your work?
They can Google Jeff Bale OISE, and they'll find there's the University of Toronto is outsourced to some third party to revamp our profile pages. They don't look very nice, but I can't tell you the URL. Our project, I'm going to pre-advertise it. So we have created a new project site, Omeka. It's O-M-E-K-A. It is a website that is designed for archivists, for historians. So it might look a little, feel a little clunkier than a Wix or a Squarespace, whatever they're called, but it's designed for historical work. And so we have called that the LARCH project, Language, Race, and Policy in Contemporary Canadian History. It's larch.omeka.net is the URL. The website is not yet ready.
Okay.
So you can find it. We haven't hidden it and it won't look very nice. But if you give us 3 months' time,
you got it.
You'll see some pretty things there. But we're really proud of the name. I'm going to tell you the name, the story of the name if I can.
Yeah.
I'm not a good person for names, number one. Number two, at Omeka, you have to create a URL to be able to create a space to play with.
Sure.
So that forced us to do a name. So we're sitting with some wonderful graduate students, and we did the keyword approach. This is education policy. It's language. It's around race and anti-racism. It's around history. And we did all the different permutations. And we got something like LARCH, even though the P of policy is not there. But shh, don't tell anybody. But then the beauty of it is I knew LARCH was a tree, but I've forgotten that LARCH is an evergreen tree, whatever the proper word for that is, that actually changes colors.
Oh.
And it's also indigenous to northern climates.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're driving around my part of the world in Ontario, you will see what look like evergreen trees, but they're yellow in the fall, which you think maybe they're sick or dying, but no, they're actually LARCH trees. And it's also a street that I actually forget if I lived on or we did, my family, before I was born in Long Island, where I was born on Long Island in Nassau County. I think my brother lived there. Then I was born, we lived somewhere else. But it's connected to my family's history, too. So it's a nice little confluence of things. But the hybridity of an evergreen tree that changes colors felt really nice to the hybridity and the dynamism of the ideas that we're investigating in our project. So that will be a site to explore for the project itself. And I'm on Twitter at Jeff Bale TO. That's my handle on Twitter.
There you go.
Fantastic. Jeff, before we sign off, we'd like to ask you to share a word in a language you speak, love, are learning, want to learn, that doesn't exist in English, but you wish it did. What is your word?
So I a little birdie over lunch told me I would ask this question. Uh-huh. And as the birdie said that, the very first word that came to mind is Fußhupe. Which, I guess it's a compound noun that brings together the words in German for foot and horn, but like wah, wah, the kind of horn, like car horn or bike horn, and it refers to a small yappy dog.
Yeah,
and I'm not really a big fan of small yappy dogs. And I don't actually know. You can correct me, Angelica. I don't know if the word in German implies doing something with your foot to a Fußhupe, but I've often one of the jokes is like drop kicking a small yappy dog.
Yep.
But that is why I laugh every time I hear the word Fußhupe and every time I say the word Fußhupe. Because living in a big city, I'm surrounded by condominiums filled with small yappy dogs.
Uh-huh.
So it might be a negative way to end this little podcast.
No. We
alas,
like it.
I think it's a really funny word. Yeah. I mean, small yappy dog, right? It takes three words in English to say fußhupe of Deutsch.
I love it. That's a very good one. I approve. Well, Jeff, this was wonderful. Thank you so much for speaking of language with us today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Next week, Cornell is on spring break. We'll be back the following week to hear from Dr. Carolyn Fornoff about her new book, Subjunctive Aesthetics, Mexican Cultural Production in the Era of Climate Change. Until then,
auf Wiederhören.
The Language Resource Center is located on the ground floor of Stimson Hall on Cornell's main campus in Ithaca, New York. Check us out on the web at lrc.cornell.edu.
And follow Cornell LRC on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Speaking of Language is produced by Angelica Kramer and Sam Lupowitz.
Recorded by Sam Lupowitz.
Original music by Sam Lupowitz, Dan Gable, and Joe Gibson.
Thanks also to the College of Arts and Sciences at Cornell University.
As a reminder, the ideas and opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect those of the College of Arts and Sciences or any other official entity of Cornell University.
We thank our listeners, and do stay tuned for our next episode.